Welcome to the Wellbeing Rebellion, the podcast that's changing workplace cultures for good. We're your hosts, Ngazi Weller
and Obehi Alafoje.
Let's get this rebellion started. This week on the Wellbeing Rebellion, I am speaking with Julie Dennis. Julie is a diversity and inclusion specialist with over 20 years' experience gained within the public and the voluntary sector. As head of inclusive workplace policy at ACAS, Julie is responsible for leading ACAS's inclusive workplaces policy program covering EDI and wellbeing. During her career, her work on D&I has been recognized repeatedly and was named as an inspirational D&I leader of 2021 in the Global D&I Leaders Benchmarking Survey 2021, and featured in a publication that showcased the most inspiring business women to watch in 2022. And she's certainly an inspiration to me. Julie is a proud mum to her daughter Jasmine and grandmother of two grandsons, Isaac and Reuben. Julie is passionate about diversity and inclusion in the workplace and strives to create an environment where people can be themselves at work. In today's episode, we delve into how employers are finding themselves navigating the tricky employee relationships. Now, rebels, take note as Julie shares some remarkable insights. There are a few technical issues when it came to the recording. Technology is fantastic when it works. So we had to resort to good old tried and tested methods of Teams. So please bear with us if the sound quality isn't what you're used to. Continue to listen. I promise you, she's worth it. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the Wellbeing Rebellion.
Hi, Ngozi. How are you?
I'm all the better for having me, Julie, with me. Thank you.
Oh, that's very kind of you. It's lovely to get back together with you. I think when we met last year at that wellbeing event, I found a kindred spirit in the inclusion world.
To be fair, I never thought of myself as an inclusion champion or anything like that, but life has other ideas. And to find people like yourself who are truly allies, forces for good, fighting the good fight and putting their money where their mouth is. It's just so heartwarming. And that's why I really wanted to invite you here to the Wellbeing Rebellion and to share the benefit of your wisdom, your experience with all of our listeners, because I just know there's going to be so much that they can learn from you. So thank you for coming.
Oh, you're welcome.
Let's just start, just because not everybody knows Julie Dennis like I do, but you should. Can you just tell us who you are and who you work for and all the about the great work that ACAS do?
So first of all, so like you said, I'm Julie Dennis. I'm the head of Inclusive Workplaces Policy Team at ACAS. A little bit about me before I go on and tell you about the great work we do at ACAS. So I've been working as a ED&I practitioner for over 20 years now, and I feel really blessed and privileged that I'm doing a job that I really love. It's something that I wanted to do when I first started looking at my career and thought, you know, what do I want to do with my life? Where can I make a real difference? And I think because of some of the challenges I'd faced in my childhood and my early years as a young woman, I wanted to work in a place where I could make a real difference. And inclusion, or equal opportunities as it was called back then, really called to me. So once I graduated from university, and I went back to university as a mature student, although I wasn't that mature, I was 25, so I was still a baby. And I did a bit of work in the voluntary sector to begin with, and then I got my first role working for the Fire and Rescue Service as an equality advisor. And that was a really interesting time back in 2001, actually, because the fire service was going through a lot of changes, dealing with a lot of stuff around harassment and bullying. some people will say they're still dealing with that, but we did make some great strides back then. And it really helped me cut my teeth in the inclusion world. And then after that, I then joined the civil service in 2007, and I joined ACAS in 2016. First of all, came over as their head of inclusion and diversity, and then last year came into this new role as head of inclusive workplaces policy. And like I say, my passion for inclusion is really deep rooted in my own values. I come from a blended family. You know, I'm one of three. My mum got divorced when I was young. I then got married very early, had a baby, got divorced. So by the end of age of 21, I was a single mum. My daughter's also mixed race. So I actually saw that firsthand impact of how society sometimes treats people differently. And I didn't like what I saw. And that's one of the other reasons why I've gone into this work. So I feel really, really lucky and really privileged that I do the work that I do, and absolutely thrilled that I get to work for ACAS, who are an amazing organisation. And for those people who don't know who ACAS are, we are a government department, but we work independently of government. So we're here to provide that impartial advice to employers and employees across Britain. And the things that we try and do is we help prevent unresolved disputes between employers and their workforce. We also provide information and advice and training. We settle complaints about employee rights, and we're quite successful in doing that. And most importantly, we encourage people to work together more effectively. So to give people an indication of the type of volume of work that we work, so looking at our figures from 2022-2023, we have an amazing website that's free to access for everybody in the UK. And last year we had over 14.4 million visits to our website, and we also had over 10.5 million visits to our advice and guidance on our website. We also dealt with over 649,000 calls to ACAS, and 10% of those calls were in relation to workplace discrimination. And we received over 105,000 early conciliation notifications, and we trained over 41,000 people. So we are quite a busy organisation. There's a lot of challenges out there in the world of work, and ACAS is seen as the go-to place for employers and workers to come and get that advice and guidance. In regards to my team, like I say, I lead the Inclusive Workplaces Policy team. And it's a new team in ACAS. We only created back in May 2023. And my team's role is to develop ACAS's policy influence and activity for some of the biggest challenges facing modern world of work, and also contributing to our overall aim of ACAS of making working life better for everybody in Britain. And of course, when we're talking about everybody, we're talking about everybody, and that's where the inclusion element comes in. So since my team was created, we've been really busy developing our new Inclusive Workplaces policy plan. And that's going to help us set out the priority work that we're going to focus on both during this year, but also as part of our new ACAS strategy that will come into force in 2025. And in order to get that plan up and running, we've done a lot of reading, done a rapid literature review. We've spoke to quite a lot of stakeholders. We have this privileged position that we get to access a lot of stakeholders to get their views. And it's really important that we get views of other people, so we don't work in this isolated model. And one of the key things that we found when we were doing our research is that one of the key barriers to workplace inclusion is that lack of understanding that line managers have around inclusion itself, and their capability in holding tricky or sensitive conversations with workers. We also found that, you know, there's not the right resources out there in businesses, especially those smaller businesses who may not have HR departments. And then you'll have these rigid policies and an unsupportive culture, which also gets in the way of line managers trying to do the best for their people and get the best out of their people. So, you know, part of our work now is to help organisations steer their way through that tricky situation sometimes that they may get in.
You were talking about the biggest barriers to inclusion being line managers and their capability understanding. And I thought, actually, I wonder how much we all really understand about inclusion. So what is the distinct difference, at least in your opinion, between diversity, equity, and inclusion? What do those three strands of ED&I mean? And in practice, what does that mean in the workplace?
So that's a really good question, Gosie, and it's one that we get asked a lot of times. And, you know, I can go through the technical, you know, diversity is this and inclusion is this and, you know, equity is this. But if you look at it really simple, and I forgot the wonderful person who come up with this phrase, so apologies for not name checking this individual, but it's something that I've steeled with pride. But to me, you know, inclusion or diversity, it's about being invited to the party. You know, a lot of people are left out in work situations. So, you know, when we're looking at creating an inclusive culture, it's about inviting people to that party. It's letting them have their voice. It's letting them speak. But it's also not only inviting them to the party, but it's letting them dance. And I think for me, when you take that a little bit further, you look at belonging, it's about and letting them dance like nobody's watching. So you can just let yourself out and be yourselves. But the other thing I always say to people, and what drives me in what I do, is to me, it's about being able to bring your whole self to work, to be you, to be authentic. Now, obviously, there are boundaries within that because you have cultures within organisations. We have equality legislation that says, you know, you must treat people in this way and you must not treat people unfairly because they may be different to you or they may have a different protected characteristic to you. So there are boundaries in that, you know, bringing your whole self to work. But the majority of people, I believe, in the UK come to work and they want to do a great job and they want to get on with their colleagues. And they don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, whose life can I make a misery today? You know, most people come to work, they've got well-meaning intentions. They just want to get on with the job. They want to do an amazing job, get on with their colleagues. And sometimes they get into situations where they may have a difference of opinion with someone they work with, or, you know, people are people. We don't like everybody. You know, it's like you say you can choose your friends but not your family. Well, that's same at work. You can't choose everyone you work with. And again, it goes, you'll know as well as me, you know, I've worked with some awful people over the years, but you have to be polite and professional. And sometimes you just have to keep some of those personal opinions to yourself, because I think what I find is where people start trying to put onto somebody else, well, I believe in this and you should follow this and you're wrong. That's where you get the conflict. But I think the other thing as well, when you're looking at inclusion, it's about recognising that just because somebody, for example, may have a particular disability, that doesn't mean that that disability affects that individual exactly the same like somebody else who's got the same disability. It affects us all differently. You know, and I think, you know, we've had conversations before about, you know, that lovely thing at the minute that we're both going through, menopause. Me and you are going through menopause differently. You know, we're both on HRT, we'll be on different levels, different doses, and it will affect us differently. Why will it affect us differently? Well, first of all, we're both different ethnic backgrounds. So again, it's recognising that as women, we're not all the same. You know, we'll have different history in terms of our medical conditions and stuff like that. So it's about, I think, where people struggle or where maybe inclusion's gone wrong in the past is people have tended to say, you're in this box, so you must look like this, or you must do this, or you must behave like that, instead of going, actually, we're all different, we're all individuals. And I think where you're looking at managers in organisations or leaders in organisations is actually saying, what is it I need to do for you to enable you to perform to your best? What are you finding difficult at the minute? that's preventing you from doing a fantastic job? Because I know you can do a fantastic job. That's why I hired you. So I think it's what we're trying to do now in that whole inclusion piece is move away from having this checklist of, if you have an employer and it looks like this and behaves like this, this is what you need to do. And it's about actually tailoring things to the individual, but remembering to come from that well-intentioned approach that I'm not trying to make your life difficult. I'm not trying to be, you know, a blocker. I'm trying to enable you to be the best version of you within the workplace.
You make it sound so simple. To me, I think it's simple. And I call it that lovely forward approach to life. Don't be a dick, right? But it's not that easy for every manager to be able to say as eloquently as you did, how can I help you to do the best job you can do? Because I know that's all you're interested in, and I know you're capable. They're not all able to do that. Why do you think some managers find it really hard to have that conversations around EDI, whether that be race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, different ability, whatever it is? Why do we find, even just as people, why are we so uncomfortable having these discussions? And I think the answer is different depending on what you're talking about. I know societally, we've traditionally talked about EDI through the lens of gender inclusion or disability, physical disability. Increasingly now we're talking about things like neuro ability or neuro inclusion. The one that I think people still find very difficult to talk about, race. That's still a real big blocker for people to feel comfortable addressing. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we can't get under the skin of this stuff in the workplace?
I think it's because, you know what, we're human beings at the end of the day. And actually having those conversations, you know, when you're a manager of a team of people or you've got to have that conversation with someone, there's always that fear, or there may be your own prejudice, but you're worried that you're going to get it wrong. Or you may have seen where someone's tried to do that before and they have got that wrong, and then they've ended up with that litigation and stuff like that. And I think we're all a lot more aware of how we come across to people. I do think as well that some people need to be a bit kinder at work and see their managers as human beings as well, because there's this expectation that the manager knows what they're doing or they're doing it for the wrong reason. So I think that adds on to that fear around, you know, I'm worried that I'm going to get this wrong. And especially when I think, again, some of the language we use, you know, when I work alongside HR professionals and they'll say, right, you're going to have a difficult conversation, so these are things you need to think about. Well, straight away for that manager, it's like, oh my God, it's going to be a difficult conversation. Could I get in trouble? You know, without thinking, actually, how's the person feeling? You've got to have that conversation. They're probably worried, especially, you know, if you happen to have a conversation with someone who's struggling at work because they've just been diagnosed with a certain condition, they're trying to come to terms with that diagnosis. Worried, I'm going to lose my job. I've got a mortgage, I've got a family, I've got all these responsibilities, and I'm going to lose my job if I say the wrong thing. So you've got both parties that are both worried about having this conversation instead of actually thinking about what is it we need to talk about. I think it's really interesting that you spoke about neurodiversity. Again, we know in ACAS that is a real growing issue. We get a lot of queries around neurodiversity. We've got guidance we did a few years ago that we're going to be revisiting this year because it's one of our most commonly viewed pieces of guidance. And then we've also got the whole explosion that happened after COVID with mental health. You know, so you've got people more aware of how, you know, when they're in conflict at work, it does affect your mental health. Nobody's happy when they're stressed or when things aren't going right. So again, you put those different layers on top and that inhibits those conversations. And again, when we were doing our research, look at what we want to put in our plan, you know, a lot of research was saying that managers make assumptions around the needs of their employees instead of actually asking those simple questions. And plus, there's this perceived lack of capability for line managers, especially if they're handling multiple related issues and grievances, because, you know, people are employed to do a job and then all of a sudden they get promoted and they've got to manage people, and they may be really good at their technical skill but may not have those interactions to talk to people. A lot of companies do not give managers the space to have those valuable conversations. So when they're having those one-to-ones, it's about how many widgets have you done this week? And instead of going, actually, how are you today? How's life? What's happening with you? What are things that are going really well? What's going not so well? What can we do to help that? And I think that's what inhibits those conversations. And again, at ACAS, we did some research back in 2021 when we looked at the cost of conflict in workplaces. You know, and back then, the cost of conflict was costing UK organisations £28.5 billion.
Billion pounds.
So that's equivalent to £1,000 for each employee. And close to 10 million people experience conflict at work. And of those, over half suffered stress, anxiety and depression as a result. And then you've got people taking time off because of that. You've got people leaving. You know, nearly 500,000 people resigned from those organisations, and more than over 300,000 employees were dismissed because of that conflict. So again, you know, we know at ACAS that having those early conversations with your people saves money. It saves time and it promotes better well-being, because your people are your best resource. And if you think about the cost it costs to hire someone and then train them up, and then you've got that conflict happening and you don't resolve it, or you don't have those open conversations, you're going to lose all that talent. So it's, you know, that we know at ACAS that being able to have those conversations is a real essential ingredient to good management. And like I say, it promotes that positive impact on an organisational's effectiveness and performance.
And that's everything that we've been saying for quite a few years now at Aurora as well. Yeah. But you mentioned that it's not just about upskilling the line managers so that they know how to have the conversations, because I know there's a lot of discussions and lots of training programmes now about courageous conversations. But I take it back to, that's why we have a 360 approach to establishing psychological safety in the workplaces, because you've got to structure the line manager's role so that they have time to do this stuff. Yeah. And businesses seem to not get it. They're not really getting it. Or the key people who are able to say, yes, all right, this is going to mean that managers have to have less of the functional stuff that they've got to do so that they can have more time to do the management piece, that it's still I'm not seeing enough businesses take it up, which is a shame. But it's good to know that ACAS is providing the same kind of advice and guidance, because that's really the secret to it. Newly, this trend, I say newly, it's been in the last year or two, that belonging has been joined with DEI. What does that mean?
Again, I think it's like I said earlier on, it's being able to bring your whole self to work, isn't it? It's being able to feel that you're part of that organisation. It's feeling that, you know, you can be yourself, and being able to be yourself means that you can perform to your best. I mean, it's quite interesting, because like I say, I've been working in this area for years and years, and I'm not a big one for, what's this word mean? What's this word? It's, you know, I think that is a smokescreen. People get too tied up on, like I say, when I first started, it was equal opportunities, and then it became equality, then it became diversity, then it became inclusion, then it became equity, then it became, you know, belonging. And you've got managers going, I just want to do my job. I just want my team to perform. And it's like, it's just, my view is, let's just forget about what all these words mean. What is the best way that you want your people to perform to your best? And it's about seeing people as individuals, having those conversations, being brave to have those conversations, and also recognizing, you know, just because somebody may fit in a particular box, if they're underperforming, and you've put everything in place to enable them to perform, to enable them to do their job. There is also the circumstances where you come where some people just aren't the right person for the job. Some people haven't got the skills for the job. I think, again, you find line managers are really frightened to have those constructive conversations. And, you know, I've been a manager for years and I've been managed and I've worked alongside amazing managers. And some of the conversations I've had with colleagues over the years is, you know, sometimes you get two groups of people. You get those people who just want to come to work, do a good job, are really committed. But unfortunately, you do get some other people who think the world owes them and they're going to come to work and they're not going to do anything and they're going to hide behind all whatever they can. And as soon as they get challenged because their manager is a good manager and is noticing they're not doing the job, then the next thing they do, they'll go, this isn't fair. You know, I'm being treated differently because of X, Y, and Z. And, you know, if I had a pound for every time someone phoned me up during my career saying, this isn't fair, I'd be sat on a nice beach now, actually, with a drink and, you know, under the sun and chilling. I think we have to get it down to that. It's that fairness bit, isn't it? And I think when we're looking at inclusion sometimes, we have to recognise that society on a whole, it's not been fair for certain people. Certain people have had more advantages or privilege than other groups of people. And we have to recognise that that's different for different people. And sometimes it can come down to your own social background. It could come down to where you've grown up, what opportunities you've had during your childhood to open those doors or not, who you know, what you know, and it's recognising that the world of work isn't always fair for some people and we have to remove those barriers. But sometimes there comes a point where actually we have to have those honest conversations with people sometimes that's like, well, actually maybe we need to look at doing something differently here. Or worst case scenario, sometimes we have to look at we need to part company because actually the way you behave is not fit for what we see in this organisation, or you've done something that's, you know, classed as gross misconduct or whatever. And again, I think managers get really, really nervous having those conversations because we've made the process too complicated.
And this is something that people we work with and prospects have always been confused about. The fact that, well, now that everybody's talking about well-being and mental health, does that mean that everybody can come and say, oh, my mental health is affected, and we're just making it too easy for people not to work? And there was an article that I read last week in which Mel Stride, the Work and Pension Secretary at the moment, said that our approach in the UK to mental health is at risk of going too far. And he said, as a culture, we seem to have forgotten that work is good for mental health. And there's a real risk now that we're labelling the normal ups and downs of human life as medical conditions, which then serve to hold people back and ultimately drive up the benefit bill. And he was referring to the number of people that are off work due to long-term illness, which is at a record high. So the Office of National Statistics reported 2.5 million people are off on long-term illness this year, which is more than has ever been. And managers, and even their managers, so HR and CEOs, they're all worried about, well, I don't want my workforce to feel like every little bit of stress they have, they can just claim sick. And I always say, well, that's not going to happen. The majority of people don't do that. It's a small minority of people who cry wolf, right? And so you don't legislate for the minority. You legislate and prepare for the majority. And then when the minority comes, you can weed them out. But what's your thoughts on this? Are we becoming, in a way, too soft and we just can't take the normal slings and arrows of life like we used to?
So, again, at ACAS, we know that, you know, an individual needs to take responsibility for their own mental health and well-being. And, you know, that chimes really strongly with me. as an individual who myself has a mental health condition, I manage it. You know, I've got PTSD, was misdiagnosed years ago as depression, which I think a lot of people have experienced that. You know, and I know what my triggers are, and I know how I'm very lucky. I've got a really good line manager that I can have those open conversations with and flag up when things are not as good as what they normally can. But I take that responsibility, and I also, you know, make that time in my life to be able to have a rest and recompose myself and relax if I get the chance, to ensure that I can be the best version of me when I'm at work. You know, one of the things that a lot of organisations need to look at is first of all, emphasising that we all have a personal responsibility in terms of our mental health, and recognising that we all have mental health. The majority of us, for the majority of times, will have good mental health, but there'll be occasions where we'll have poor mental health, and then it's what support can we put in place to make sure that we can help you through that process. Because again, we know that if people take time out, and the longer they take time out, the harder it is to get them back into the workplace. So again, it's about thinking about what are the things you're putting in place in your organization to enable people to have the space to have those conversations, to be able to step away from the, you know, the day job, to be able to look at themselves and see how they're doing. And you're right, it's a minority of people that will take advantage of that. The majority of workers in the UK want to come to work, want to do a good job without having to deal with people who may treat them differently because of who they are. And they have to put up with that nonsense. And I think, you know, over the years, I've met a lot of people that have not had the best working life. You know, they have faced racism or sexism or sexual harassment or, you know, homophobia at work. And actually, it's, you know, every time I've spoken to people about that situation, they've always said, I just want to come to work and I just want to do my job. And I just want to know that there's fairness. So I want to know that if I go for promotion, that I'm going to be treated just as fairly as anybody else who's going for that promotion. I'm not going to be automatically being three steps behind the starting line because of who I am, or because someone else is going for that job and they're best friends with the person who's interviewing, or they've had the inside track on what's happening. And I think, you know, the majority of people just want to be treated fairly when they come to work. And I think when they don't, that's when that adds to that stress and that anxiety, where then actually they may find they're not performing as well as what they can do.
So what are some of those key skills or policies and procedures that employers can use to ensure that everyone can perform their best at work, that they do have these inclusive, fair workplaces that encourage everybody to have a good working life?
So I'd say, first of all, for anyone who's got to do this, it's first of all, it is a conversation. And you need to be, before you even go into that conversation, you need to be able to take a step back and think, right, I've got to be able to manage my emotions and the information that I'm going to receive from the person I'm having the conversation in a sensitive way. Because you may be wanting to talk to that person about their performance or their conduct, or you may be having to deal with a complaint or a grievance. Or you may be, you know, most of the time you're dealing with personality clashes. This person doesn't get on. You know, it's a bit like those of us who've got children. They fall out sometimes. And how do you deal with that effectively? And also it may be, you know, as managers, sometimes we have to deal with delicate situations. For example, you may have to turn someone's request for annual leave down because you've got to have so many people in. It's about, again, being able to do that in a fair way. So what I always say to people when they're going to have that conversation is, first of all, the first question you should ask is, am I the right person to have this conversation? Because you may not be. You may actually do more damage than good. You may go in this well-meaning, but actually you're going to make a, you know, a real ash of it, and it's going to just all go Pete Tong. So first of all, am I the right person to have that conversation? And if I'm not, or do I need some advice, then do I need to either speak to my line manager to just get some advice, or one of my peers? Or if I'm in an organisation that's got HR team, do I need to, you know, talk to them first to get, you know, a few tips of how to have that conversation? And then once you've identified that actually you are the right person, it's about making sure that you have that conversation as soon as possible, because the longer you leave it, that could then lead to other complications where, you know, you might mislead your employer that actually there's not a problem here, so what they're doing is right, or you deny them the chance to improve or put things right, or that might damage productivity, or, you know, the worst case scenario, it lowers that morale amongst your team, because your team goes, well, this person doesn't deal with poor performance, or, you know, when these two people are falling out, this person just stays away with it because it's too difficult. The other thing as well, what I say to managers is you need to think about how you're going to have that conversation. So what words are you going to use? What tone of voice and body language are you going to use? I mean, I always talk about, I remember when I first started in the civil service and I had a manager and I used to have my one-to-ones, and halfway through, he'd start looking at his watch or looking out the window, and I'd be sat there thinking, have you got something more important that you need to be doing, you know? I didn't feel that time I had with them was really important. So, you know, you need to make sure you're engaged in that conversation and you're not going, right, I've only got 5 minutes to sort this out, so make it quick. Straight away, that person's going to think, well, what's the point? They're not interested. They've got something more important that they're interested in. So I think the other thing as well is when you're having that conversation is, you know, stick to the facts. You know, this is what we've seen, this is what happened, you know, and then listening to what the person says. So, you know, thinking about how what they've said comes across, and check that you understand what they've said, because sometimes we'll only hear key words. So relaying that back, you know, can I just clarify what you've said is X, Y, and Z? And then having a clear agreement that, you know, the changes that you're expecting or the improvements that you're expecting, what you expect going forward. I think the other things as well is about showing that empathy side of you. So that appreciation and acknowledgement of another person's feelings. But don't do that one of, oh, yes, I know what you're talking about, I went through that. Because, again, that really, you know, really puts you off, doesn't it? When you're telling someone the problem and say, oh, yeah, I had that happen to me. Or, oh, you know, again, I can remember having conversations years ago around menopause and speaking to a senior leader who just went, well, I had no problems, I sailed through the menopause, I don't see what the problem is. And straight away you're like, oh, well, I'm not going to talk to that person. They don't get what I'm trying to do. So don't, you know, yes, show empathy, but see the world through their eyes, you know, but don't lose that sight yourself as well. And appreciate that it may be an emotional conversation. So again, pick up on that and reflect that back to them. And it may be that sometimes you may need to reframe the conversation, depending, because you can go in thinking, right, I'm going to talk about X, Y, and Z. And then you start having a conversation and something else comes back. So, you know, you may need to sometimes reframe the conversation, shifting the emphasis from the negativity to the positiveness and getting rid of blame and remaining really constructive on what are the solutions that you can put in place during that conversation. And like I say, it sounds really easy, really simple, isn't it?
When you
spell it out. But, you know, I've been in that situation. I've had to have those conversations. And it's really, really hard. And I think sometimes it's about just going in there and saying, you know, actually, this is hard. This is difficult. But let's try and find a solution together. Because I want you to do your best. I know you're amazing. I know you know you can do this, but I've noticed that over the last few weeks, you're not working to your full potential. What's happening? What are the difficulties? And again, it's reframing the conversation. It's about saying, what are you finding difficult? Rather than, you know, at ACAS, we're doing some work around reasonable adjustments, and we know that not all firms are find it easy to put adjustments in place. And one of the things they'll say is, well, people don't tell us. And that's because they probably say, have you got a disability? Or let's talk about reasonable adjustments. Instead of going, what are you finding difficult at the minute? How can I improve that? What can I put in place to make it easier for you to do your job effectively?
I mean, when you say that, and it's to me, like I say, it seems obvious, but when you just said that, it reminded me of how we deal with toddlers who were in the terrible twos and threes versus how we often deal with teenagers who are similarly in trifling and difficult times. When it's a 2 or 3 year old and they're having a strop about they can't, I don't know, put their coat buttons on by themselves, we almost naturally have that empathy and understanding that the problem that they're facing is just beyond their ability to solve it, but it's not insurmountable. And what they need is a bit of patience and love and to be spoken to in a way that reassures them that they're capable and blah, 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 blah. We tend to approach that in that sort of way. What's the matter? How can I help you? Would you like some guidance? Do you want to do it yourself? Sometimes mummy and daddy do it this way, blah, 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 blah. We know that. And yet when it comes to parenting teens, we tend to be much more, well, you should know what to do. You should know what the problem is. And I think I'm not saying that your employees are toddlers, but if you approached it from the sense that, okay, I've got this awkward situation, I'm going to treat it like I would a toddler having a tantrum, as opposed to a teen not doing their homework or not listening to me, and have that same level of empathy and care, approach it with that same attitude, maybe that would work.
Yeah, I mean, again, I've met many EDI practitioners. I can remember one of my colleagues I met years ago when I was in the fire service. You know, she said her previous career was working in schools with primary school children, and she found that actually that skill was really beneficial for her working in organisations. And I think it is, it's that having that conversation with a person, but also recognising that, you know, you as a manager may go, do you know, I don't know why they're getting so stressed about this, but for that individual, this is their reality. This is how they're seeing the situation affect them. So it's about being empathetic to that, and not by dismissing how they feel, the emotions they're going through, how the fear they may be facing. And I think it's interesting, Gavs, that you talked about, you know, teenagers. I think, you know, those of us who think about how did we have that conversation when, you know, my daughter's what, 32 now, 33. I can remember when, you know, she first split up with her first boyfriend, serious boyfriend, and you know, really upset. And what I didn't do was say, we've all been there, you'll get over it. And I didn't. It was like more about, actually, this is really horrible at the moment, and I understand why you're feeling like that. And I think it's you do it from that approach, not from the, oh, well, you'll get over it, you'll get through the other side. It's about acknowledging that actually, I mean, you can say, look, we will get through this. We will get to when, and hopefully in 6 months or 12 months time, we can look back on this and look at how much you've improved or how better life is. But at this moment in time, that person doesn't want to hear that. They've got, this is the issue I'm dealing with. I want you to help me to make it go away, or to help me navigate through that. Or I need to know that I'm in a safe space that I can open up to you. And I think, again, that's one of the key things where sometimes you get managers that are so busy, they don't have those normal everyday conversations with their people. So you don't feel that you can open up and you can speak to your manager about anything that's happening to you. And I think for me personally, you know, I'm a manager as well, and I've always tried to, when I manage, you know, my team, is try and create this environment where they feel they can come and talk to me about anything. You know, I don't need to know all the deep, but that they feel safe, because like I say, I've had some good managers and I've had some bad managers, and I've tried to learn from the bad ones to go, I don't want anyone, you know. I can remember having a manager once, and the way they dealt with the situation, the way it made me feel was awful. And for me, it's like, I don't ever want anyone to feel like that when I'm dealing with something with them. And yes, sometimes I get it wrong. I'm not, none of us are perfect. There are some people out there who think they are, don't they? You know, I've got an ex-husband who thinks he was perfect, hence why he's my ex-husband. But, you know, we're all, sometimes we do get it wrong, and it's about being able to go, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. And for that individual, again, not to hold it against us. And I think that's what scares managers, because they've seen where someone's had good intentions, and that individual has just gone, no, I want you to resolve it for me. I want you to take this problem away without actually, well, there is some accountability for you here as well. But actually, there's some certain situations where actually I need to deal with this because, you know, if we're looking at harassment, for example, actually, that it's not that individual's fault. You know, they've been treated in a certain way through no fault of their own. And actually, as a line manager, you've got a role here to make sure that you deal with that situation. You listen to that person empathetically and you work together to get through that solution.
Mm. Thank you so much, Julie. I know you've really shared so much with us today, and I loved that very practical approach to how managers can have those uncomfortable, awkward, sensitive conversations empathetically. It strikes me as something that we could all benefit from reminding ourselves of. So before we close off, I just have one last question for you. And I know that you are a true rebel at heart, certainly a well-being rebel. So as a well-being rebel, what would be the one change that you'd like to see in workplace well-being to help make our workplaces in the UK a place where everybody can feel comfortable and safe and everybody can have that working life that's good?
I think putting it simple is, you know, organisations recognising that, you know, everyone's really, really busy. And whatever organisation you are, whatever product, policy, whatever you're working on, you need to create a structure within your organisations that gives your line managers the space to have conversations with their people. Your people are your most important resource and you need to nurture them. You need to not take advantage of them. You don't need to go, well, you can be easily replaced, because actually, as we go on, the talent pool is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So, you know, you may have been all right to go, well, if you don't like it, there's the door. But you're going to get to a point where there's not going to be anyone else to come in through the other door to replace that person. So it's creating the space to have conversations, get to know your people, be human, show your vulnerability, talk about, you know, again, I think for me, it's, as a leader, I talk about my mental health because I feel by talking about that, hopefully that'll make somebody feel, oh, actually, it happens to anybody. Or talk about my well-being and where sometimes I may have struggled, because hopefully that makes people think, actually, it can happen to anyone. So I think it's creating that space to have those conversations and not think it's all about getting the widgets out the other end.
I love that. Thank you so much, Julie.
You're welcome. Catch
you next time.
Yeah, and it's been a pleasure catching up with you as always. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wellbeing Rebellion.
If you liked what you just heard, please share it with your colleagues, follow us on LinkedIn. The link will be in the show notes, and generally show us some love.
We want to build a whole army of fellow rebels who want to create positive workplaces for everyone. Will you join the rebellion? See you next time.